in the Fireside Room. Today's speaker is Mark Schwen, and he will be speaking on what are the culture wars. So let's listen in on Mark.
My name is Mark Schwen, and the title of this session is What Are the Culture Wars? And it's really the middle of a three-part sequence, which we began yesterday. And I'll just, since I think none of you were here yesterday, and there were eight or nine others here yesterday, at least I'll try to orient this conversation within the sort of overall framework of the three sessions. Yesterday's session was entitled, Is Our Democracy Coming Apart? And we looked at a number of developments which are outlined, among other places, in this very recent book by Jean Bethke Elstein called Democracy on Trial. Those of you who are interested, we don't have this book in the bookstore, but there's a long review essay in the latest Christian Century, which is in the reading room here. Martin Marty wrote a long and very favorable review essay of this book, and you can get the gist of the book from Marty's review. And then today I'm going to be basing some of what I present on this book, which is in the bookstore, 30% off, called Culture Wars, The Struggle to Define America, and then subtitled Making Sense of the Battles Over the Family, Art, Education, Law, and Politics. Hunter has since written a sequel to that called Before the Shooting Begins, and ominously enough, in the same month that that book came out, the shooting did begin at one of the abortion clinics, and in fact, one of the main issues that he takes up, both in this book and then almost throughout the entire book Before the Shooting Begins, is that particular issue. So it's not just that it coincidentally came out with a title that had shooting in it at the same time that there was a shooting. It's that the second book is really mainly about the abortion controversy. Yesterday, in trying to pursue with the group the kinds of things which make some observers believe that our democracy is in trouble, we listed the following, and this is by way of review. The first one was a kind of growth of cynicism in our culture, and connected to that, a kind of atrophy of what we called civil society. First cynicism and then civil society. The cynicism derives in part from the extent to which we're treated all the time to scandals of one kind or another. A kind of growing culture of mistrust, of people growing to mistrust leaders of all kinds, whether this is church leaders or political leaders, other officials that hold positions of power and influence and presumably moral probity are time and again shown to be guilty of this or that scandal, and the press has a way of dramatizing these and dragging them out interminably. But there's also a growing sense of mistrust, according to many analysts, that people have toward one another. That is, not only the kind of fear and suspicion one encounters in some of our major cities, but more importantly, coworkers, people that you don't rely on or don't confidently believe will do their part if you do yours. Just a kind of corrosion in the sense of mutual understanding and trust in the society. And then that is in turn related to, though not in a strictly causal way, this more worrisome development called the atrophy of civil society. By civil society, we simply mean all of the institutions that intercede between the government and the individual. So voluntary associations, especially PTAs, for example, parent-teachers associations, churches, the family as an institution. One could go on and on. Trade unions would be examples of institutions intermediate between neighborhoods. The Lions Club, the Kiwanis Club, the Rotary Club, all kinds of service organizations. It turns out that the membership in those organizations is almost without exception declining precipitously. And that's worrisome to people who study democratic societies, because it's precisely within those organizations people have found that human beings learn the habits of compromise, the dispositions to assume responsibility rather than just assert rights, but assume responsibility. And as those begin to wane and unravel, it's not clear that the citizenry is being prepared in any straightforward way for what it means to be a responsible member of a democratic society. So that's another worrisome development. Then we talked about the rise of acquisitive individualism, that is the prevalent consumerism in our culture, where we are very commodity oriented. And more seriously than that, but related to it, is the whole subtle shift in the vocabulary of human rights from what were originally civic rights, rights one needed in order to exercise citizenship, freedom of speech, for example, okay? The right to free speech, the right to free assembly, the kinds of things that are secured in the Bill of Rights, okay? Either are civil rights of that sort, or they are immunities, that is, protections the citizens have over and against the government. So the right to be immune from illegal searches and seizures. Government can't just kind of come in arbitrarily into your home and conduct searches or monitor your phone calls and spy on you and so forth. So originally rights had been thought of in terms of civil rights or immunities, and they've come now to be identified with simple wants. Somebody wants something, pretty soon that becomes a need, and pretty soon people talk about it as a right to have X. So legitimation of one's lifestyle, we have a right to that. We have a right to health care. We have a right to... So you can make a long list, almost an interminably long list of rights, which have sprung up in connection with the whole notion of acquisitive individualism, and which are highly personal. In other words, it's my want, I want this, I have a right to this. Whereas the old civil rights and the immunities depended on your being part of a political community to secure those rights and to exercise them properly. These others are individual appetites that you have a right to have met. So that is a pretty widespread movement in our society, these presumptions of entitlements. And again, that worries students of democracy. Then we listed cynicism about procedures like voting that are basically essential to democratic processes. To move along quickly, talked about the increasing collapse in the distinction between private life and public life, so that we now see paraded on television and in the press all kinds of things that once used to be very private. You can't turn on any talk shows today without seeing certain people trotting out as spectacles all kinds of things which were 30 years ago, maybe even 20 years ago, thought to be utterly out of properly the public eye, thought to be shameful if this were known publicly, now is just kind of routinely aired. And moving in the other direction, the family has become increasingly politicized. So just as we have moved private things into the public realm, we've found the rhetoric of understanding the relationship between parents and children and so forth to have an increasingly political vocabulary to characterize it. So there's been this kind of blurring of the public and the private, and that's led to all kinds of difficulties. Then, and we only have two more, and then we'll get to the culture wars, there's this whole rise of what we call identity politics. People organizing initially as publics have always done in a democracy out of certain common interests, women who've been the victims of abuse, for example, or African Americans who have been victimized by all kinds of forms of oppression in the civil rights movement, or Mexican Americans, or gays and lesbians, whatever group you name, that oftentimes originally organizes around certain political objectives. But then gradually what has happened in terms of identity politics is that people have decided to enter the public arena only insofar as they are women, gays, lesbians, African Americans, Mexicans, and that basically they practice a kind of politics of identity as though they are without remainder, whatever that group designation means. And so what drops out of that equation is any notion of citizenship. There's no then sense of kind of common purpose. There's no commitment to compromise and work together with other very different Americans, citizens, to try to solve problems. There's only the notion, I have my set of interests bound up with who I am. I demand respect not for what I propose to do or for what I propose to legislate, but for who I am. I'm X and I'm proud of it, you know, fill in the blank. And that's basically my sense of what it means to be political. So that is really, if one had to flag the development which seems most worrisome to most of these writers, including Jean Beth Gelstein, it's this politics of identity, precisely because it seems to be eroding the notion of citizenship. And then finally, the whole question, which we won't go into in detail now, of whether or not our institutions of learning, all the way from the elementary school up through the colleges and universities, are any more equipped to or intending to educate for citizenship. In other words, to sort of form the kind of knowledge and the kind of dispositions and habits of compromise, responsibility, and a sense of a common good. Are those institutions any longer equipped or interested in doing that? The health of the democracy and the strength of educational institutions have been, at least from the 19th century onward, if not earlier, been thought to be inextricably bound up to one another. And it's questionable whether or not elementary and secondary schools, much less colleges and universities, are very much interested in providing that kind of basic education. Instead, they're often ridden by the same kind of strife that the larger society is with identity politics and the whole list of things I've just ticked off. Acquisitive individualism, I'm just here to pursue a career, don't bother me with these other things, that kind of stuff. And so it's really doubtful whether our educational institutions are serving the public good any longer. Into that mix then, and sort of cutting across it, is today's worry, and that is the culture wars worry. How many of you have heard the expression culture wars or culture war before today?
In the sense of the political religious right.
Pardon?
In the sense of the politically religious right, like Pat Buchanan, that sort of thing.
Okay, so that's the context in which you've heard it?
I would think of it first.
Okay. And you'd think of his being one side of the culture war, or?
The impression I have is that he's waging a war against what he sees as a secular culture.
Okay. Anybody else heard the term before? What context did you hear it in?
Just in the context of conservative versus the liberal. I mean, that's, especially in religious studies, I mean, it's always the liberal versus the conservative.
Okay. So you've heard it in the context of people on both sides of this alleged war are religious people, but what distinguishes them is not the religious and the irreligious, which is what you have, the religious versus secular, but within religious groups, the liberals and the conservatives.
Right. It's not necessarily denominations. Mm-hmm. It comes down to conservative and liberal.
Okay. The term is new to the other two of you there? It's not something that sort of surfaced on your screen of... Okay, let me give you what Hunter's own definition of the culture war is, and then I'll try to expand on that a bit and see if you recognize some of the phenomena that he names as being part of the culture war. He says, I define cultural conflict very simply as political and social hostility rooted in different systems of moral understanding. So that if you press back to find out what is finally beneath the surface argument over abortion, over gay and lesbian rights, over whether or not we should fund federal agencies that in turn fund art exhibits like the Mapplethorpe exhibit, for example, whether or not we should have prayer in the public schools, whether or not creationism ought to be taught right along with evolution in school textbooks. Take all of those issues, okay? They don't by themselves add up to a culture war because those are just the kinds of issues that people have disputed for a long time. But when the two different sides appeal to fundamentally different bases of moral authority, so that their disagreements are rooted in fundamentally different moral understandings, then you have, at least as far as Hunter is concerned, a culture war. Now, this is to pick up just a little bit on your point. Hunter's point in the book is that in the past, that is up until quite recently, at least until the 60s, cultural conflict in this country often took the form of conflict among the several religious groups in the country. So there were Protestants who went through a period of virulent anti-Catholicism. The 19th century is filled with episodes of very virulent anti-Catholic sentiment, and even up into the 20th century, that's true. And contrarywise, the Catholics were very hostile to Protestants. There was quite a lot of anti-Semitism in this country, so that you had Christians and Jews and tensions among them. And then the Mormons figure in here as a smaller group, to be sure, but one of no small consequence. And then again, there were some conflicts between Protestants and Mormons and Catholics, and so forth and so on. What's happened, Hunter notes, is that the conflict among those groups has almost entirely disappeared. I mean, not totally, but compared to what it was in the 19th century or even as late as the period between World War I and World War II, the virulence and breadth of anti-Semitism is way down, as is anti-Catholic sentiment, almost totally disappeared, except in a few highly reactionary Protestant groups and so forth. But what has risen up is exactly the division you're talking about. That is to say, the culture wars cut across the old traditional rivalry, so that within Judaism, within Protestantism, within Catholicism, within Mormonism, you have at least two pronounced camps that line up on opposite sides of at least all of the issues I ticked off before: prayer in the public schools, creationism, gay and lesbian rights, abortion, etc. And those two groups are operating, Hunter tells us, out of two diametrically opposite sets of moral understandings. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. Hunter calls these two groups in his book, and he admits the terms aren't perfect, the orthodox and the progressive. I mean, you used conservative and liberal, and that would come pretty close to orthodox, i.e. conservative, and progressive, i.e. liberal. But the reason he doesn't use the term conservative and liberal is because he thinks those terms describe antagonists that argue over more political interests, meaning economic and social policy. Okay, so for example, should we have a voluntary healthcare system or should we have a state-managed healthcare system and so on? And that liberal and conservative are at least on the same common ground. They both share certain bedrock assumptions about what a democracy is, but they disagree sharply over policy issues. The culture wars, the people on both sides are operating out of fundamentally different moral understandings and sources of moral authority. Both a liberal and a conservative will quote the Constitution, for example, and appeal to the laws of the land to try to make their case. They'll read the Constitution differently, but they'll appeal to the same sources of authority, which has to do with our own political tradition. Whereas the Orthodox and the progressives, he wants to tell us, would appeal to totally different sources of authority. What makes the Orthodox Orthodox is, according to Hunter, all of the Orthodox believe that there really is an external, transcendent source of moral authority. So, for example, Christians who look to the Ten Commandments and to the revealed word as sources of moral authority to appeal to would be classified in this case as Orthodox. Whereas progressives would tend to reconfigure the standard symbolism and the standard commandments to reshape those in conformity with contemporary culture. So that the progressives would tend to let contemporary culture's own norms be the lens through which they look, if they look at all, at their religious traditions, okay? Many of the progressives would be secularists, that is, would have at best secular humanism as a kind of faith, and they would not believe that there's some kind of external transcendent authority in which to anchor moral values. Okay. So then the worry here for a democracy is this. Democracies can take and are built to sustain fierce, open, honest political conflict. Normally this takes the part of conflicts among political parties, sometimes third and fourth parties. They're often individual movements, civil rights movement, for example, in which all kinds of forms of protest are legitimate. But in this case, according to Hunter, you have conflicts that are sort of in principle irresolvable because one side appeals to a source of moral authority that the other side doesn't even recognize as a source of moral authority. At least in the civil rights movement, both Martin Luther King and his adversaries in the South appealed to laws of the land, state laws, and so forth. One side reading them one way, one side reading them the other, okay? But in this case, we have one side appealing to the Ten Commandments, Orthodox Jews, conservative Christians, most of the Mormons, conservative Catholics, and the other side appealing mainly to standards of morality that have emerged from secular culture. Utilitarianism, for example, would be one school of moral thought that takes ethical questions seriously, but that does not anchor their answers to ethical questions in a particular religious tradition. So they would be, in that case, progressives. Here's another quote from Hunter that might make all this clear. He says, for the practical purposes of naming the antagonists in the culture war, then, we can label those on one side Orthodox or, and here's your term actually, cultural conservatives or moral traditionalists, and those on the other side liberals or progressives. These are, after all, the terms the actors in the culture war use to describe themselves. The danger of using these political labels, however, is that one can easily forget that they trace back to prior moral commitments and more basic moral visions. We subtly slip into thinking of the controversies debated as political rather than cultural in nature. On political matters, one can compromise. Should we have a progressive tax or not? One side says no, one side says yes. So we get a progressive tax that's not nearly as steep as the people who are proponents of a progressive tax want. That's something we can compromise on, and everybody feels that they've come away with something. On matters of ultimate moral truth, one cannot compromise. That's why the abortion question doesn't seem to move toward resolution. It seems only to get deeper, more fierce, more potentially violent. So when you have matters of ultimate truth and you have two different sources of moral authority, then you're going to get interminable and deepening conflict. When you have two people appealing to the same source of moral authority but reading it differently, in politics, you will often find the ability to compromise, as in some of the examples I gave you. Do everybody feel the difference now between a culture war and a political conflict? Is that sort of clear in your mind? Okay, now let me just say a couple more things and then we'll talk. Hunter thinks that probably as I've set out these two alternatives, orthodox and progressive, Hunter thinks that most Americans, and this would probably be a good test to see about the four of you if you'll fess up later, would say, well, you know, I don't really fit entirely in one of these two camps. And I'm sort of here in this respect, but I'm sort of there in that respect, and I kind of muddle through. On some issues, I'm more conservative. On some issues, I'm more liberal. And that most people, like 80% of them, are in the middle of a valley with, on two peaks, the two extreme sides in the culture war shooting at one another. That's Hunter's view. And I think he's right about that. But his point is that there are several features of our culture, the fact that we have an intellectual elite that shapes public discourse, the fact that we have a media who thinks that it's objective if it always has two sides to everything. Well, there's been this shooting at this abortion clinic, Ted Koppel, so now let's get a spokesman for the pro-life organization and a spokesman for Planned Parenthood, and let's give them equal time and have at it, okay? So that the media tends to think that what it means to be objective is to carve everything up into two and only two sides, and to make those, because they want to sell newspapers and get high ratings on television, to sort of make those extreme sides. So that even though most of us might be out in the middle of the valley ducking the bullets here, okay, the fact is that public discourse in the New Republic, or commentary, or the New York Review of Books, or the New York Times Book Review, or on television, Ted Koppel, or on, if you want to go down now, from the intelligentsia to people driving around in their cars, they're the right-wing talk shows, and they're the left-wing talk shows. And you can kind of call in one or the other, and people either listen to the one and get angry, or the other and have their views reinforced, but they tend to polarize, okay? So that the media acts as a kind of constant engine to polarize and make those of us in this vast middle kind of have to choose sides, or kind of into thinking that there are only two views that one can responsibly hold. You follow that? It's a very important qualification. And finally, I'll make this last point, which is, I think, very interesting, about the people on the two culture wars being diametrically opposite. The conservatives, or the orthodox, and the progressives, or the liberals, both believe deeply in freedom and justice. But the conservatives tend to define freedom economically. That is, free economic initiative, free opportunity to make money in an unfettered way. And they tend to define justice socially, meaning righteous living, living in accordance with a clear moral code. Progressives tend to define freedom socially, though, meaning individual rights of the sort I talked about earlier, and justice economically, that is equity. So, in other words, the liberal progressives, when they talk about justice, they're thinking a fair distribution of goods and services, therefore a progressive tax, you see, that basically tries to even out the economic playing field a bit. And so they're all kind of marching to the same key words, more freedom, more justice, but they mean, and that is important to understand, because someone might say, well, but don't these people share certain common values after all? Well, yes and no. They share the values, freedom and justice, but if you look hard at what they're talking about very different things when they use those words. Okay. Let me just stop now. I've given you, I think, you've all nodded, so I've given you, I think, a pretty good sense of what we mean by a culture war and why it's, at least in his judgment, so worrisome. And it's another acid that's eating away at the fabric of democracy, because it acts against what's essential to democracy, which is the possibility of compromise, the possibility of citizens working together. It's very divisive and potentially, he thinks, violent. That's why he wrote the book Before the Shooting Begins. Well, let me just stop and ask, are all of you part of that 80% that doesn't really quite feel like you belong in the orthodox camp and belong in the progressive camp, and saying, well, neither of those is me? You're all nodding. Is that...
Initially, when you defined the terms, I thought, yeah, I'm somewhere in the middle, until you got to the justice and freedom definitions, and I saw that I fall very clearly into the progressive camp, that those are the ways that I would define.
Justice economically and
right.
And freedom socially.
So then it became clear to me where I stand.
Or at least you have a pronounced tendency in that
right.
Direction.
You're
in the 80% as well. Well, that's what we would expect a representative of the State Department not to.
Very diplomatic of you.
Marty, you?
I'm in the Valley.
You're in the Valley too?
Yeah.
Now, before this session and my laying this out, I know a couple of you had heard the term culture wars. You'd heard it with Pat Buchanan, his famous speech,
right.
Which basically then was, in effect, we've got to define, and this is subtitled, The Struggle to Define America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, America's been taken away from us, he says,
right.
In his speech, and we have to reclaim it for ourselves. It's gone the way of secular humanism, permissiveness, relativism, and what we need to do is to kind of reclaim it for the solid, sturdy family values anchored in the biblical tradition. And then he went on to say some things that made him sound verging on things like anti-Semitism and verging on things like anti-immigrant. In other words, there are too many of these people coming in with foreign values and so on. We want to reclaim America for the Americans, meaning those who honor the Judeo-Christian tradition and, in Hunter's words, the Orthodox, you know, who have a secure, transcendent, external source of authority that they can appeal to. And so that's a very good illustration of one side in the culture war throwing down the gauntlet to the other side. Hunter's point is further in this book that you people, all of whom have now said that you're in the 80%, though maybe with some pronounced P tendencies, you're sooner or later going to be drawn into the culture war. In other words, you're likely to be drawn into it if you're a parent in the local school district elections, because both sides are trying very hard to run national campaigns to seed the school districts for the purposes of prayer and the purposes of textbooks. There's a tremendous battle over whether the textbooks have been written by the progressives and now imposed upon the citizenry, and whether we shouldn't find textbooks written by the Orthodox. and imposed on the citizens. This whole worry about the connection between democracy and education. So you could be drawn into it in the PTA or in the school board elections. That's one place. You could very well be drawn into it in terms of the abortion controversy, one way or the other. In fact, Hunter, in another book, says that the abortion controversy is to our culture today what slavery was to the pre-Civil War generation. Namely, that it was an issue that wouldn't go away, and that no matter where you started, you finally wound up talking about abortion. So, for example, Congress wants to pass a bill about health care. Okay, so you have all this debate about health care, very elaborate. And then somebody tacks on a rider that, okay, the one thing we won't fund is abortion. Okay, and so then you're right back in the middle of that culture war. All of the possibility of negotiating out politically the terms of equitable health care for all Americans gets focused finally on some rider having to do with abortion. And that's exactly what happened in the 1850s with slavery. In 1854, Stephen A. Douglas wanted to build a railroad, and in order to build a railroad, he had to settle territories, and in order to settle territories, he had to get congressional authorization, and immediately the question arose, well, would the territories be slave or free or whatnot? And you had a huge debate on whether the Nebraska Territory would be admitted as a free state, a slave state, or, as Douglas wanted, a kind of popular sovereignty. Hunter says that the same thing is starting to happen in our political discourse, that we may start out talking about a political issue about which we can compromise, and quickly then that'll be funneled into one of these non-negotiable cultural issues because people are working out of diametrically opposite sets of moral understandings. Is that clear how that sort of happens? Yeah.
When you mentioned that the progressive was, you can categorize them as utilitarianism, and that would leave the orthodox camp necessarily as deontologists, right? Because they're opposite. But to name the liberals progressive, I think, is misleading. Because when you talk about utilitarianism, you think of an extended goal to be achieved. And deontology can also, in a sense, be a reforming movement of morality. If he wants to get away from political terms such as liberal and conservative, I don't think he can. Because whether you talk about abortion, creationalism, or anything such as that, I think you can trace them back to being political, in the sense that we're all part of a city, and we're all political animals, in a sense. So I don't find the words progressive and
orthodox
helpful at all.
Mm-hmm. Basically, because you don't really think that it, you think it's kind of artificial to try to disentangle politics and culture.
Right. I don't think you can. I mean, maybe he wants to, and maybe try to get away from it and attack it from a new perspective, but I don't know if you can necessarily.
Mm-hmm. What do the rest of you think of that? That there's something artificial about trying to disentangle cultural issues from political issues?
I think that's exactly what you've just been talking about, that a seemingly unrelated political issue, that you, once you start discussing it, you realize that your foundation is, you know, fundamentally different from someone else's. It does seem a slippery slope. You know, I mean, maybe you can hold them apart to a certain extent, but I think Marty's right that if you go into it in any depth, eventually you'll find yourself at that bedrock, you know, of what you believe, and that will cause a real disagreement, fundamental kind of disagreement.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier that at one time both parties like referred to the Ten Commandments, the Constitution, and now we have two separate moral parties. Is that accurate? I mean,
In the he says his historical basis for introducing the term culture wars is fairly new. Is the whole process that begins really after World War II, where you get two simultaneous developments. One is this enormous explosion in higher education, made possible by the GI Bill, but then fueled by the country's desire to catch up with the Soviets and so forth in the late 50s, National Science Foundation, huge federal infusion of funds to support higher education, vast numbers of people now getting a college degree. So that what you got was a huge proportion of the population that were attending institutions of higher learning, and those institutions of higher learning at that same time were moving totally into a non-sectarian posture. That is to say, they became engines of secularization. They were quite sure, not just the public institutions, though them mainly. I mean, like as late as 1937, places like the University of Michigan had chapel attendance. Okay, so I mean that's shocking to most people, but it's true. Even the public institutions had often required attendance at religious services. Well, can you imagine that at Indiana University today that we're going to require everybody here to attend services? I mean, it's just unthinkable. But in 1937, it was going on routinely. So when you get this huge number of people attending colleges and universities, and you get at the same time those colleges and universities divesting themselves of any vestiges of connections to religious traditions, and being at best neutral over against religious views, and at worst hostile to all religions, then you introduce a whole new mentality into public discourse. You have provided a kind of training ground for what we would call here the progressive wing. And sure enough, sociologists have studied and tried to correlate what's the key variable that distinguishes the progressive so-called from the conservative so-called, or the orthodox so-called, and its level of education. Basically, the more education, the more likely people are looking as sources of moral authority to places other than religious traditions. And the less education, there's more tendency to look to a kind of straightforward, literal reading of the Ten Commandments, or, well, for both Jews and Christians, or other sets of moral laws in other sacred scriptures. So, to answer your question, yes, basically, Hunter would say, and I would say, and I think most historians would say, that in the 19th century there was much more of an integration between public life and religious traditions. The whole vocabulary of political discourse was filled with religious allusions. Last time we've seen that in this country on a widespread scale was probably the Civil Rights Movement, when the rhetoric of King was clearly grounded in a biblical tradition of justice and so forth. We still hear a lot of religion in public life, but now it's more strident and divisive. Now it's one side of the culture wars. King was probably the last person to appeal to a broad range of the American public drawing on biblical imagery. But that time is gone, according to Hunter. Other comments or questions about this?
How does this, does he speak at all to the issue of differences between cultures, say between the United States and other countries, or is this only a...
He doesn't talk much in comparative terms,
okay. But
he would certainly say, if he were, I think, that the other democracies, the other older Western democracies, not the newer rising democracies who are paradoxically looking to us at the very time our democracy is coming unraveled, according to some people, would be much more secular That is to say, if you go to Britain or the Scandinavian countries or France, they're just utterly perplexed that the American people seem so religious and so caught up in religious issues, and that figures still so prominently into public discourse. So he would probably think that though you have pronounced conflict in those countries, it's more of the, quote, strictly political kind over policies that are negotiable and compromises possible, and that here that would be less true because of the resurgence of certain religious traditions and the division within those traditions that I talked about earlier, which is a new development in our country.
To what extent do you think that the term fundamentalism applies to orthodoxy as you're talking about?
Oh, he would say to a great extent. He would locate all of the fundamentalists. All fundamentalists would be orthodox, but not all orthodox would be fundamentalists. In other words, you could be an orthodox person, meaning that you believe there's a transcendent external source of authority, without necessarily having to be a fundamentalist. But if you're a fundamentalist, you're definitely in the orthodox camp. There are, in other words, people who you would call orthodox by Hunter's description, who have fairly nuanced ways of reading the Bible, where they don't think that everything in there is kind of straightforwardly applied to contemporary culture, who would not then therefore be fundamentalists, who have a kind of literal-minded reading of the text frequently. So you could have an orthodox person who would say, look, the prescriptions in Timothy about women in church just don't apply now. They were really for the time of Paul, but they don't apply to our present-day context, and those things change and should. And that person still would be orthodox because he or she would be still appealing, finally, to the Bible as the ultimate source of moral authority. But fundamentalists, of course, would have a particular way of reading those texts that would locate them in orthodoxy
Accept the hypothesis that, you know, there are two fundamentally different sources of authority leading to, you know, insoluble arguments here, the future doesn't look very bright.
Well, that's why Hunter wrote his sequel before the shooting starts. Uh-huh. And what we're going to talk about tomorrow is precisely what citizens, especially but not only citizens who are Christians, might do as we begin one by one in some place or another, whether it's a PTA meeting or a school board or our local clinic, which may or may not perform abortions but may have picket lines in front of it and so forth, and we have to decide whether to cross them, or whether it's the funding for the arts, or whether it's any of the other things on here, family values, etc. The notion is sooner or later we're going to be drawn into this, and the task tomorrow will be to see whether or not there are some special resources within the Christian tradition that can help us navigate this situation without being drawn into one of the two extreme positions.